Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Return from Babylon, Lecture 2, Episode 2 of 3. In the previous episode, we talked about how the Jews who returned from the Babylonian exile arrived in Jerusalem and started rebuilding the temple, and how the Kutim, or the Samaritans, were trying to obstruct that process. In this episode, let's find out how they did it. In Israel today, the Samaritan community is greatly diminished in numbers. As a rule, they live in two cities. They live in Holon, where there's a small Samaritan neighborhood, and near Shechem, not far from their sacred mountain, which is called Mount Gerizim. They're like a modern-day curiosity because they consider themselves to be the real Jews, meaning they are willing to admit that we are somewhat Jewish, but they are the real Jews. They believe that originally the temple should have been located on Mount Gerizim, near Shechem, and not on Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. At one point, their temple was located on Mount Gerizim before it was destroyed, and to them, this is sacred memory. And so, today's Samaritans, on the night of the 14th of the month of Nisan, as was customary for the Jews 2,000 years ago, when the temple stood, they continued to bring the Passover sacrifice to their temple. And on the nights of the 14th to the 15th of Nisan, the same as the Jews did 2,000 years ago, they eat the Passover offering and matzah. If anyone wants to see this curiosity and to experience how Jerusalem was 2,000 years ago, they can go to Mount Gerizim and see the modern Samaritans. They still have a high priest, and they still bring sacrifices. They practice a peculiar kind of religion. They have their Sukkot holiday. For Sukkot, we build a hut. They do too, but they believe that the hut can be an apartment, just as long as you call it a hut. They have mezuzahs, but not like ours. They inscribe random words right on the doorposts, just as the Karaites. Today's Samaritans have a big problem. Since they didn't marry outside of their community, it so happens that now there are a lot more Samaritan males than females. Around 7 to 8 years ago, they were in a tough predicament. When it was time for the son of the Samaritan high priest to get married, there weren't a lot of Samaritan women to choose from, so he asked his father, the high priest, what to do. And the solution was to import a bride from the Ukraine, which has now become standard practice. Turns out there are many potential Samaritan brides eager to leave Ukraine and go pretty much anywhere else. And so they all started marrying Ukrainian women. The very son of the high priest, the one who would be next in line to be the high priest, married a Ukrainian woman, then someone else did, and so on. Well, I am not saying that every one of them married Ukrainians, but they mostly did. This became a problem. For the first time in hundreds of years, or maybe even thousands of years, Samaritans had to start marrying outside of their community. These are the modern-day Samaritans. That's why if we take a closer look at the modern-day Samaritans, we can see that all is not well in their community. But at one time, things were quite different. The Samaritans were many in numbers, and were the main nemesis of the Jews. When the Jews returned from exile, all the nasty deeds, dirty tricks, and sabotage were done by the Samaritans. They were the terrorists of 2,000 years ago. Nowadays, Samaritans are peaceful and docile, but back then they were like Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. So how did the Hamas of those times come to be? With the friendliest of intentions, of course, in the year 534 BCE, at exactly the time when the Jews began rebuilding the temple, the Samaritans paid them a visit and said, "You are reconstructing the temple." The Jews replied, "Yes, it's been 52 years since it has been destroyed, and we are now rebuilding it." The Samaritans then stated, "We will rebuild it with you." Zerubbabel told them, "Thanks, but we've got this," and declined the offer. The Samaritans got very offended. Why did Zerubbabel turn down their offer, and why did the Samaritans think that they were entitled to take part in the reconstruction of the temple? There were two kingdoms, Judea and Israel. In 722, before the Common Era, the Assyrians destroyed the kingdom of Israel, and the 10 tribes that lived on that territory were banished. We are still searching for these 10 tribes, thinking that we'll soon return. It's been said that they are beyond the Sambation River. During the week, its current is so strong that it's impossible to cross, but on Shabbat, it's calm. However, you're not allowed to break Shabbat to cross it. That's why the 10 tribes are stuck there, so the story goes. Anyway, the capital of ancient Israel was Samaria, and now it was vacant, so the Assyrians decided to relocate the Kutim there. There's a difference between Assyrians and Babylonians. After a conquest, Babylonians just exiled the people of that territory and didn't care what happened after. But the Assyrians had a somewhat different idea. They relocated the entire population of a conquered territory to a vacated, unfamiliar one. Kutim used to live on territory, present-day Afghanistan, and are probably of Aryan descent like Iranians. They were forced out and sent to live in Israel. When they arrived at this unfamiliar, ravaged land, terrible things started happening. At that time, lions were very common in the land of Israel. There were a lot of lions roaming around, which would often attack people. They say that the last lion was killed by the Crusaders in the 13th century. But 2,000 years ago, there were plenty of lions in the land of Israel, and they were attacking the newly arrived Kutim. The Kutim were afraid to live there and wrote the king of Assyria asking him to relocate them somewhere else before they all were eaten by lions. They pleaded with the king of Assyria to do something because it was so dangerous to live there. So the Assyrians asked the Jews, "What's wrong with your land? Did you live in a zoo? Why are these people saying that they are being attacked by lions?" The Jews replied, "Look, this land is very special. One has to live there in a certain way. If the Kutim are living there in the same manner they lived in Afghanistan, it's no wonder they're being attacked by lions. So what's the solution? Send a delegation of Jews over to teach the Kutim the correct way to live on this land." The Jews explained to the Kutim, "Guys, if you want to live well on this land, you have to live like we used to live here." And they taught the Kutim some laws that have to do with Judaism. The Kutim really liked and appreciated everything they heard and inevitably intermarried with some of the Jews, and that's how they came to form their own identity. Like the modern-day Karaites, they claimed that they observed Judaism. But their Judaism was a peculiar one. So that's how they lived for 52 years while the Jews were in exile. They were convinced that the religion they practiced was real Judaism. They have forgotten their Kutim origins and believe that they are the real Jews. And the Jews that were now returning from Babylon were not the real Jews. For 52 years, they practiced their peculiar religion and considered this land to be their own. It's been disputed that the Samaritans underwent an authentic conversion to become real Jews, or that their conversion was not kosher. According to the Talmud, they are either Gerei Arayot, Arayot are lions in Hebrew, meaning they converted because they feared lions, or they are Gerei Emet, true converts. Anyone who converts to Judaism sincerely is deemed to be a true Jew. Anyone who converts without a true intention of becoming a real Jew and does it for ulterior motives, such people are called Gerei Ariot, meaning lion converts, and are not considered to be true converts. In any case, the Samaritans at the time we are talking about had a peculiar type of Judaism. They had no intention to have the Jews build a temple there. Moreover, they believed that the temple should not be located in Jerusalem, but near their capital, Shomron, where they now live by Mount Gerizim. They were not expecting for a group of foreigners to move in and start making their own rules. The Samaritans, who had been living there undisturbed for 52 years, numbered far greater than the Jews. Now they wanted to figure out how to get these disagreeable and unwelcome foreigners to leave. They figured it would be too scandalous to just kill all of them. It needed to be done in a less obvious way. But how? So they devised a plan. They were going to get in the way of the reconstruction of the temple and build it the way they wanted to. As a result, the Jews would give up and leave, and the Samaritans would continue as they were, thinking that they are the real Jews. Zerubbabel was on to their game right away and turned them down. So the Kutim proceeded with a plan. They wrote a letter to King Koresh, sent it to Babylon. We talked about how King Koresh had the big idea that all peoples conquered by the Persians should live in peace and tranquility. This was the credo of the Persians. They didn't force anyone to become Persian. Every nation should live in peace. The main thing is that there is peace and taxes are paid to Persia, and then all will be like Ahura Mazda once. Suddenly, King Koresh received a letter, a long letter, which read something along these lines. "Dear esteemed King Koresh, for 52 years our life has been good here, with no worries. We loved the Persians a lot. We were doing just fine until 42,000 thugs came to threaten us. They've come to Jerusalem. They're going to rebuild the city, and not just the city, they're going to rebuild the temple. This may be quite concerning to you. As you know, a temple is primarily a fortress. They're going to build a huge fortress. Little by little, they're going to gather because they believe that the Persians are not really their sovereigns, and they will demand their independence. Sooner or later, they will create big trouble for the Persian Empire. They will bring about a terrible uprising. We, as loyal citizens of the Persian Empire, cannot just stand by and watch this outrage. Therefore, we ask their King Koresh to stop this from happening. King Koresh sensed a possible ethnic conflict brewing. He did not need any ethnic conflicts, so without giving it much thought, he ordered to suspend the construction of the temple temporarily until he had time to take stock of the situation and then decide what to do in the future. The construction of the temple was suspended. The Jews were in complete shock. Lebanese cedar was already being imported from Lebanon. They had already begun restoring the altar. The Jews were rejoicing, and then came such a blow. So the Jews sent a delegation to Susa, which was the new capital of Persia. The delegation was led by a man whose name was Mordechai. Mordechai went to Susa to tell King Koresh that this is a complete farce, and the Jews were not going to rebel against anyone. They just want to rebuild the temple. When Mordechai arrived at Susa, King Koresh was not here because he had gone on a new conquest. And during that time, he died. A new Persian king replaced him. The Persian king was Ahasuerus, and he engaged in campaigns of conquest of his own. But the Jews wanted to know when they'd be allowed to resume construction. Ahasuerus didn't want to deal with this problem, so he said, "It's best to leave things as they are. Keep the status quo. The Jews can go about their lives just fine without a temple." So the Jews who pioneered the return from Babylonian exile to raise their homeland from the rubble and started rebuilding their heart, the temple, were now left in a state of limbo and despair. The Jews that remained in Babylon and monitored how things were going for the pioneers that went back to Israel so they could join them when the going got good were now convinced that they made the right decision by not coming. Things were not going well. The construction of the temple was suspended, and it was unclear if and when the Persians would allow it to continue. The Jews in Persia would have to remain there longer. As detailed in the book Megillat Esther, which we read during the Purim holiday, Ahasuerus threw a huge feast in the third year of his rule. The Jews were invited. They were told to enjoy the delicious kosher food and consider how good their life was in Persia. They were told, "Why will you want to return to your old homeland? What do you need a temple for? Persia is now your homeland." This is when the event that could have led to the total destruction of the Jewish people unfolded. Ahasuerus had a prime minister whose name was Haman, who was a rabid anti-Semite and wanted to destroy all of the Jews. Queen Esther, a Jewess, who was forced to marry Ahasuerus, saved the Jewish people. Meanwhile, the Jews in the land of Israel went on living, not knowing what tomorrow would bring, and their lives were a struggle. 12 years passed. There was no new temple. 2 more years passed. Now it's been 14 years and still no temple. Ahasuerus ruled for 12 years. When he died, his son Darius became king. He was a great king, and that's how historians referred to him, Darius the Great. He was the one who made the Persian Empire greater than it was under his father, King Ahasuerus, and greater than under King Cyrus. Under Darius became a truly great and powerful empire. He built roads and a new capital. He thought that Susa was a fine city, but a great empire needed an even grander city, a man-made masterpiece. He wanted the city to be visible from all directions, so he built it on a special platform. He named the city Persepolis. This was a fairy tale city. It was like something out of the tale of the Arabian Nights of 2,500 years ago. No one lived there all year. The only time people went there was for major holidays, mainly for the Persian New Year, which was in the spring, and there were thousands upon thousands of visitors. The visitors would see the palace and the hall where the king presided. It had an area of 12,000 square meters, almost 3 football fields. The throne room was surrounded by 72 columns, each 20 meters high. It was a magnificent, majestic structure. And when all the subjects of the Persian Empire came to pay respect to the king, they could behold the magnificence of Persepolis and feel like they were living in a great empire. During his rule, Darius engaged in vast military campaigns. He had already extended the Persian borders through mainland Europe. For his next conquest and expansion, Darius had his eyes set on Athens and the Greek city-states. By the second year of Darius's rule, the Jews still did not have a temple. At this point, it's been 14 years since construction was paused. This was also the time when prophecy was waning in the land of Israel. Zechariah, Haggai, and Malachi were the last Jewish prophets. They told the Jews that it was time to restart construction, but how could they? The king ordered them to stop. Restarting now would be like a revolt against Persia. But Zechariah and Haggai insisted that the time was now and never. With their prophetic vision, they assured the Jews that nothing bad would happen. So, with renewed confidence, the Jews began construction. This worried the Samaritans. They thought the Jews were subdued, and out of the blue they started building their temple again. So what did the Samaritans do? They wrote a letter, of course, this time to Tatanai. The entire Persian Empire was divided into provinces called satrapies. There were 20 such satrapies, and the governor of each satrapy was called a satrap. One of the largest satrapies, including present-day Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and part of Iraq, was ruled by Tatanai. Tatanai was a satrap, or governor of this province. He received a letter from the Samaritans which said that the Jews had begun rebuilding the temple. Tatanai went to the Jews and said, "On what grounds did you guys start reconstruction of the temple?" They replied, "What do you mean on what grounds? We have permission." King Koresh gave his permission 14 years ago and then suspended it temporarily. He never said, "Not allowed," he said, "Temporarily." 14 years have passed, so we've started construction. Tatanai was not aware of any such permission and decided to write a letter to Darius, asking if the Jews were telling the truth. The letter stated the following. The full text of the letter is in the book of Ezra. To King Dariavesh, that's how Darius was called in Hebrew, with well wishes, let it be known to the king that we went to Judea, the land of the temple of the great God, and it is being built of heavy stones, and wood is being inserted into the walls, and their hands are making swift and successful work with this. We spoke to their elders and have said to them, who gave you the order to build this house and raise these walls? On what grounds are you doing all of this? And we asked their names to notify you and to record the names of the men who are their leaders. He went on to describe their lengthy dialogue. Darius decides to get to the bottom of this and sends his archivist to Babylon, where the archive was during Koresh's time. When they arrived in Babylon, they didn't find any records, so King Dariavesh sends them to another city where there was an archive, and there they found an old letter. In this old letter, written by King Koresh, it really did state that he authorized the Jews to rebuild their temple. They also found a second document where King Koresh was said to suspend construction temporarily. However, it didn't say why he said to suspend it. Satisfied with these findings, Darius writes a letter to Tatanai saying that the Jews may continue building the temple. To learn how the temple was rebuilt and who the main figures were behind the reconstruction of the temple, stay tuned for episode 3 of Return from Babylon.